You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Alex Leishman, CEO and CTO of River, one of the best and most focused Bitcoin financial institution now. How are we describing ourselves?
Yeah, we call us a financial institution. Can't say bank yet, but.
Yet. Interesting characterization there, but one of the best in the world. Good friend. Been on the show many times, but it's time to catch up. The world is chaotic out there. Many people are worried. Bitcoin is at $67,000. It's detached from the NASDAQ. Gold and silver are pumping. Epstein files have been released. It's all over, sir.
Yeah, you know, apparently Epstein's Satoshi.
It's been a combination of hilarious and tiresome watching the narrative slow through over the last few weeks. But
yeah. There's been a lot of new information. I think one of the problems with the whole Epstein thing is sort of, you know, it's like the ultimate boogeyman, right? And this guy who was very rich and connected for a long time emailed people in all walks of life all over the world. And unfortunately, some of those people were working on Bitcoin. And so everything seems to get sucked into his orbit, unfortunately. It's sort of like a... like Wikipedia, you know, how many hops does it take to connect two things? It's sort of like, what's the hop between anything important and Jeffrey Epstein? It's basically like, you know, one or two. And so I think everything, not just Bitcoin, is getting pulled into all of that.
Yeah, it's almost like it was a concerted effort to wrap almost everything in his web.
Yeah, exactly.
But we don't have to belabor the Epstein files. I think... Well, I love catching up with you is because you have some deep behind the scene knowledge of what's actually happening in terms of adoption of Bitcoin. I mean, you interact with your clients, with individuals and businesses every day, your research team. Shout out to Sam and everybody putting a lot of effort into your research reports, trying to figure out what's actually happening on the network. And this morning, you released your basically state of Bitcoin adoption reports, and there was a Lightning Network report that went out yesterday. And so I think it'll be good to start there. Like, what are you guys seeing behind the scenes in terms of Bitcoin adoption in this? Are we calling it a bear market, or is this a bull market correction right now?
I would call it a bear market. I think it's a bear market. Yeah, we gave a little taste of our adoption research, and we're going to have a much more thorough report coming out next week. But really, yeah, I would call this a bear market. The price is down over the last year when, tech stocks, gold, other things have rallied a lot. But what's different in this bear market, and we've been through a lot of bear markets at River, I've been through even more just personally, at this point, 13 years working on Bitcoin, the adoption hasn't really been slowing down in this bear market. Historically, we saw capital flee. We saw adoption really come to a halt during previous bear markets when Bitcoin was in a much smaller era of its life. And that's not really happening right now. Business adoption of Bitcoin continues to grow. Individual adoption of Bitcoin continues to grow. The smart money continues to allocate to Bitcoin. And so that's, happy to dig into that. But I think that's like what's really interesting here. And so, we detail a lot of those findings in this report we're going to put out.
Well, that's one of my favorite periodic updates you give is the type of businesses that are onboarding to River and adopting Bitcoin. I think that is high signal, and I think this could dovetail into the adoption and distribution of ownership charts that you guys have been putting out over the last week. But this is a signal that, I always look for is somebody runs a business. Yes, we're a media business focused on Bitcoin specifically. So it makes sense that we would invest in Bitcoin as a treasury asset and use it for payroll and other things as well. But I think I've always been waiting for that sort of mainstream breakthrough for business owners who have nothing to do with Bitcoin, recognizing that it's worthwhile for them to hold some on their business balance sheet. And it seems like that's accelerating.
Yeah. What we've seen in the last year is that the individual ownership of Bitcoin has decreased, or, you know, the net sort of the amount of Bitcoin in existence, the percent held by individuals has gone down, and the percent held by businesses has increased substantially. So, yeah, if you look at this chart, you know, you can see that the Bitcoin held by individuals has been eaten up by businesses. Now, it's important to point out, you know, individuals at the end of the day are still the owners of businesses and ETFs and things like this. But I think what this is showing is the Bitcoin is maturing. It's now like this never would have happened in a previous bear market, right? In previous bear markets, who would have thought that the transfer of Bitcoin would be happening from individuals to businesses and Wall Street? And on the business side, what we're seeing is this isn't all just financial institutions. This is also Main Street businesses. The businesses that so in the last year, right, the Bitcoin prices went down, and the amount of businesses that accumulated Bitcoin at River doubled. So, we saw record growth in the amount of businesses buying Bitcoin, despite the flat and down market. So, then you could ask. Then the obvious question is, well, if all of this is happening, then why is the price dropping? And I think that is actually the most interesting question there is. And I don't think anyone knows the full answer. It's obviously a market full of millions of actors, each making their own decisions. But I think what we're seeing is, while this transition is happening, there's some short-term price, downward price movement, because some of the individual Bitcoin being transferred is like early whales selling. We're definitely seeing some of the early big holders selling and sort of diversifying their wealth after holding Bitcoin for over a decade. But then we're also seeing, I think, the result of some more sophisticated, maybe less ideological large institutions own Bitcoin, using it for leverage, trading it when needed, selling it because it's the most liquid asset out there on their balance sheet to sell when there's any sort of scare or fear in the market. And so I think this basically, like, the price downturn is the result also of the institutional adoption of Bitcoin for various reasons. But I think long term, this is bullish.
Yeah. As you see here on the chart, too, you have the 2024 figure of net Bitcoin moving from individuals, and it was negative, I think, 525,000 Bitcoin around there, if I recall correctly. So around 1.25 million Bitcoin moving out of the hands of individuals towards the sort of entities on the left side of this chart here. And that's what I think. I think a lot of people look at businesses see plus 489,000 and they think, oh, this is the digital asset treasury company is scooping up all the Bitcoin, but they're certainly getting a large amount of it, but it's not just these types of businesses, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're also beyond just operating businesses. Well, and actually, just to give you a taste of like who's buying, you know, Bitcoin at River, we really see it all. We see summer camps, putting their excess cash in Bitcoin or using our Bitcoin interest on cash product to hold some cash, but also earn Bitcoin on the interest. We see construction companies, real estate companies, restaurant chains, food manufacturers. A really cool one is that there is this, there's an order of I won't be too specific, but sort of a Christian group, a Catholic group that has been saving in Bitcoin for a long time, and they use the capital gains on that to finance some construction of new buildings. So we really see like a really broad array of institutions and businesses buying and using Bitcoin. And it's really, really cool to see, because all the news on Twitter you see is like this Bitcoin treasury company, BlackRock, and everything we see behind the scenes is real Main Street institutions allocating to Bitcoin.
So, freaks, when you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their motto is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. It always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com. So, freaks, if you've been listening for a while, you've probably heard us all talk about BitKey. It's a Bitcoin wallet built for people who want self-custody to actually fit into their lives. BitKey is a private multi-sig wallet that removes the biggest point of failure in traditional self-custody, the seed phrase. No ceremony, nothing to hide, and no single mistake that can put your Bitcoin at risk. We all know, things get lost. I lose things all the time. Phones get replaced. Life happens. BitKey specifically is designed so your Bitcoin stays secure and recoverable without demanding constant attention or expertise. Because it's built for the long term, inheritance is built in, so your Bitcoin can move securely into the next generation. It's Bitcoin self-custody built for real life, and for February only, for you freaks, okay? February only. You got 28 days, not a leap year. I'm pretty sure 28 days. You listeners, TFTC listeners, can get BitKey for $99 using code TFTC99 at bitkey.world. That's bitkey.world. Use the code TFTC99 and you're going to get a BitKey for $99.
Yeah, and I think the pumping of the treasury companies and BlackRock and all that, and the BlackRock stuff really grinds my gears, because everybody's like, BlackRock bought this amount of Bitcoin today, or BlackRock sold that amount of Bitcoin today. And it's like, well, actually, like, they have customers that are buying their ETF, and then they have to go out there. So I think BlackRock is buying it on behalf of their customers. So technically they are buying it, but there's a bunch of individuals driving those flows in and out of that IBIT ETF. But I think one thing, because we did, it was funny, you guys dropped this chart last week, the same day. Here at TFTC, we made this ownership distribution sort of infographic video, for lack of a better description, on the go here. And many people are looking at this chart, watch that video, and said, oh my gosh, like, the individuals are giving up their sovereignty. And it's true, obviously, to an extent. It's undeniable from the chart. More individuals are selling their Bitcoin, as you said earlier, a lot of whales. But I think getting into the sort of the nature of this rotation, and is it okay? Is Bitcoin losing its ethos as this peer-to-peer digital cash system for individuals to leverage? Or is this just the product of maturation? And should this be expected?
I think that it's to be expected. If you look at any mature asset, there's a lot of institutional involvement, right? No asset can hit maturity and be globally important and have no major institutional involvement. I don't see how that could possibly work. But that said, I do think it's important that as actors in the Bitcoin community, if you want to call it a community, or just in the Bitcoin network, we recognize that, you know, there's an increasing amount of actors in this network who are less principled and sort of don't really share the early ethos of Bitcoin. And so we need to make sure that the governance and the governance of the protocol doesn't get taken over too much by people who don't actually follow the ethos. So, you know, exactly how to accomplish that, I think it's, you know, it's going to be something we have to sort out over the coming years. And I'm not actually too worried about it, but it is something we should be thoughtful about.
Yeah. No, I think people look at this chart right here. Institutions may own a majority of Bitcoin within a decade and shriek. But it's something, I mean, I think MVK made this clear to me many years ago. It's like, hey, if Bitcoin's successful, everybody's going to want a piece. And right, whether we like it or not, these institutions have way more firepower in terms of capital to deploy into this. And as I was mentioning earlier, I think it's also important to recognize that many of these institutions represent thousands, sometimes millions of people as well.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. And so then this chart is really just like, if we linearly extrapolate what we're seeing, which may or may not happen, but I do think it's illustrative of, if this trend continues, here's what it looks like in 10 years.
Yeah. Which is wild to think. And I think I'm a big fan. I've been reading a lot of Scott Adams books and a big, big fan of reframing. And I think reframing this is like, wow, it's been incredible that individuals have been the largest adopters up to this point, 17 years in. I think we should be incredibly thankful that we were crazy enough to take the risk before any of these institutions did.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you had a lot of pioneering, crazy individuals driving this thing forward and sometimes risking it all for over a decade to make this thing and to make Bitcoin important. And yeah, I love that reframing. Wow, how incredible.
Yeah, we're going to win. Absolutely. And then, I mean, it's again, going back to like, we're in a bear market, price is down, people are freaking out, wondering, oh, are we going to lower? Is it over? Stuff that both you and I have seen throughout our more than a decade of experience in Bitcoin. I find it funny when we get to these points, especially now that we're above a $1 trillion market cap and we have all these institutions adopting Bitcoin. It's like, it's never been more de-risked. And if the price goes to these levels, you should view it as an incredible opportunity. But this is just on the sort of adoption of Bitcoin as a store value asset. But the other research that you guys released yesterday that I was mentioning earlier on Lightning Network too, and Lightning's had I think Lightning has been besmirched and sort of thrown to the wayside, particularly by those in broader crypto who think there's better ways to do things. But last year was a banner year for Lightning. I think in November alone, Sam's data, and again, you have to sort of guesstimate because you guys, I think it would be helpful for you to describe how you guys actually go about that Lightning research specifically. But what was it, $1.1 billion in volume in November 2025 alone?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the cool things about Lightning is it's, you know, it's built the Bitcoin way. It's built in a decentralized, it's a decentralized L2. So unlike a lot of the, you know, Ethereum or other L2 networks that just are basically just databases, centralized databases, the Lightning Network has no central place where you can observe all of the payments happening. So you have to kind of triangulate the metrics. And we're in a pretty good place to do this because we've been a pretty sizable node on the Lightning Network for since we started, really, so for 7 years, almost 7 years now. And what we do is we look at our own data and then we partner with other big participants in the Lightning Network, other node providers, other exchanges and node operators, and we info share with them. We have them share their data. And then from that, we sort of extrapolate and make an estimate of what we think at least a lower bound is on the transaction volumes happening in the network. It's great to see. It's nice to see the growth. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of this is driven by more and more exchanges having adopted Bitcoin. I mean, having adopted Lightning. Coinbase, I believe the latest is like around 10% of their Bitcoin transactions are on the Lightning Network, which is pretty good. I think where we see where the challenge still is for Lightning is self-custody consumer Lightning wallets. Because of the way the Lightning Network works, it's challenging to get those functioning really effectively. There's some cool companies really trying to, you know, level things up there. I think let's see, it's a hard technical problem. It's a hard economic problem. So let's see what progress those companies can make in the coming years. Companies like Moon Wallet, Async, LightSpark's kind of got its own L2 Lightning hybrid called Spark. So,
well, pulling on that thread, I think 2025 was another banner year for Lightning in terms of having a clear product market fit. And the meme has been like its best product market fit is this connective tissue between all these disparate sub protocols that exist outside of Lightning, like Spark, Liquid, Chami and Mints, Arc, the Arc protocol now. And what are your ideas about around that? And particularly when it comes to like scaling and creating these consumer apps to make it easy to use Bitcoin. Like you have Bull Bitcoin with their liquid to Lightning sort of functionality. Breeze, I believe they're leveraging Spark in their SDK. And so you're beginning to see all these different sort of implementations of wallet infrastructure that leverages multiple protocols to provide different trade-offs for end users.
Yeah. I think really the bigger question is what is Bitcoin's short to medium term potential as a medium of exchange? Because I think that if Bitcoin is highly desired as a medium of exchange, that economic force will pull forward all of this innovation and we'll just figure it out. I think the actual biggest headwind to these technologies really getting in the hands of consumers, the self-custody payment network type scaling technologies, is just there isn't that big of a demand for Bitcoin as a medium of exchange today. It's growing, but it's not like, you know, Tether is still far more popular than Bitcoin, for example, right? The global demand for a medium of exchange is still overwhelmingly dollars. And I think that's actually like the biggest thing. And I don't know that any technological innovation solves that. I think you could say, let's say we developed the perfect scaling technology that was perfectly decentralized, perfectly censorship resistant, perfectly private, infinitely scalable for Bitcoin tomorrow. I don't know how much that actually moves the needle on people using Bitcoin as money. I think that's like the right thought experiment. And so I think like there's a, you know, until like the inflation really starts getting crazy with the dollar, I don't think we'll see Bitcoin widely used as a medium of exchange.
I think I would agree there. Unless you're like diehard, like living on a Bitcoin standard. Mm-hmm. Or demand it. Like that's the other thing, like merchants need to demand it. Employees need to demand it. We have many at TFTC that do. And so just via nature of those demands that get paid in Bitcoin, we have to use it as a medium of exchange to make sure we can make payroll for them. But yeah, I mean, bringing this to stablecoins, like, and obviously I think we can combine a bunch of things here. You got stablecoins, you've got the political environment here in the United States, particularly around crypto and with a very specific focus on stablecoins. And at the same time, we've got this emergence of this AI agentic economy, and everybody's racing to give these agents different types of wallets. And it seems like this administration has been overly favorable towards the crypto lobby because they threw a lot of money at the administration during the election, and now they're getting a lot of influence on Capitol Hill. What are your thoughts on this sort of nature of we're sort of in the room now, but crypto's in the room as well, and a lot of what I would deem to be idiotic ideas are being taken seriously, and maybe some distractions away from the signal that is Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think, you know, the unfortunate reality of you know, the confluence of politics and capitalism is that sort of short-term money, even if it's coming from bad ideas or scammy things, can get a lot of influence in politics. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of. And, you know, I think that it's overall probably good that they're just like chilling out a bit from a regulatory perspective. The real challenge for all of us was getting debanked. And the fact that that risk is basically is you know, a fraction of what it was is, you know, better for everybody in this industry. I also, yeah. So, you know, as it relates to all the legislation being debated, yeah, it is kind of interesting, right? Because you have, there's a small group of the Bitcoin crowd like us that are just sitting there watching all these other people debate in DC about things we really don't care about. All the debates are around the things that are going to make the big guys, the big crypto casinos, a lot of money. And that's stable coins and moving tokens away from the SEC as the regulator into the CFTC. And so, yeah, it's kind of like I watch it. I watch the debates, but I also don't really care about what they're talking about, because it just like, you know, it's just none of it's about Bitcoin. So that's how I feel. I think stable coins are like, I think they're interesting if you live in a country that has capital controls and you want dollars. Other than that, I have a hard time seeing where they're really going to take off. I could be totally wrong, but it just doesn't seem like for domestic use case in the United States, stable coins just don't seem that compelling.
What's up, freaks? This rip is brought to you by our good friends at Silent. Silent creates everyday Faraday gear that protects your hardware. We're in Bitcoin. We have a lot of hardware that we need to secure. Your wallet emits signals that can leave you vulnerable. You want to pick up Silent's gear, put your hardware in that. I have a tap signer right here. I got the Silent card holder, replaced my wallet. I was using Ridge Wallet because it's secured against RFID signal jacking. Silent, the card holder, does the same thing. It's much sleeker, fits in my pocket much easier. I also have the Faraday phone sleeve, which you can put a hardware wallet in. We're actually using it for our keys at the house too. There's been a lot of robberies. They have essential Faraday slings, Faraday backpacks. It's a Bitcoin company. They're running on a Bitcoin standard. They have a Bitcoin treasury. They accept Bitcoin via Strike. So go to slnt.com/TFTC to get 15% off anything, or simply just use the code TFTC when shopping at slnt.com. Patented technology, special operations approved. It has free shipping as well. So go check it out.
What's up, freaks? This rip was brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. It's so delicious. It's in my pink lemonade electrolyte mix. It's pink Himalayan salt. There's no sugar. It's way better than LMNT Liquid IV. I went through a big electrolyte kick testing them all out, and I landed on this, settled on this, been drinking it pretty consistently every day for 2 years now. It is my favorite. This is the pink lemonade. They have orange here. As you can see, this one's ripped. I had this on the train ride back from New York last night. I'm always stocked up with these things. They also have creatine packets. Very convenient, particularly if you're traveling and you like to work out. You like to get those brain juices flowing. They have these creatine packets as well. They're about to launch a bunch more flavors, lemon lime, watermelon, and a few others as well. So go check it out. Go to DrinkSote, DrinkSote.com. Use the code TFTC for 15% off. Seriously, game changer in our house. My wife drinks it. I drink it. Our boys drink it. Stay hydrated. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, hey, they're going to give us yield on our savings now.
You hear that? Yeah, it's like, I mean, I could already have a, get that, right? So it's kind of just like this weird abstraction in a bank account that is unclear anyone really needs.
Well, it seems to be a big big topic of contention right now on Capitol Hill between the banks and Coinbase specifically. I mean, this whole, and that's another interesting sort of sub theme is sort of clash or intersection. Who knows ultimately what it will prove to be, but it seems like the TradFi guys are looking at Bitcoin and crypto becoming more prominent and clutching their pearls a bit. This fight over sharing the yield on stablecoin is very interesting.
Yes, the banks don't want the stablecoin issuers to be able to pay back interest to the holders, because then they're worried that that will give them competition, because these big banks are scamming everyone. Basically, like your checking and savings accounts if you just have like the default ones at the largest banks, JP Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, they're paying like 0.01%, like most of their account holders. And they're just eating all of that money for free. And so they don't really want super consumer friendly ways to earn actual market interest rates. You know, they're fighting that. But I mean, we already offer a high yield interest rate at River. Like if you have cash in River, you earn 3.3% and you earn it in Bitcoin. So, you know, fintechs are already competing with them. I think like just bank accounts are so sticky in general that, you know, you get so many people that they've just had a Chase account their whole life and they're okay just with Chase basically taking all of their interest.
Taking it, putting it in a carry trade, levering it up like 10x more so they can profit.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting. I talked to some guys at a treasury. I was at a BPI event in DC and they're saying the banks are worried because they'd have to unwind all that. It makes them have to have a much more narrow focus. But to your point, these alternatives already exist. They exist at River with cash in, get yield. It's automatically converted into Bitcoin. And I think this gets to an interesting point because like the big clash right now on Capitol Hill is Coinbase versus the banks. Like we want to share the yield and the market's treating this like the banks are withholding this innovation from the market. Like if Coinbase wins, we'll be able to get our yield. It's like, hey, it already exists, which points to maybe positioning and a narrative problem that we have in Bitcoin. Like these things already exist. You just need to go out and find them.
Yeah. You know, I do wonder if the stablecoin debate is more around the international opportunity.
It's also like Coinbase and Circle see what Tether's doing. They're like, I want to box them out.
Totally. Well. I do think that really, you know, we're still in this build mode. And then when the economic forces that are basically set in stone really start to hit inflation, continue to devalue people's saving, the dollar savings, we'll see in the future, we'll see a large exodus from these big banks. River, we're building the financial institution for a future that's where the dollar is still, you're still stuck using the dollar as a medium of exchange because of the network effect, but it's not something you want to be saving in. And so, we envision a future, we call it like a dual money future where people save in Bitcoin, but they continue to primarily still spend and earn in dollars. And we think that type of account is going to replace the traditional bank accounts. And that's what we're building towards. And, you know, it's pretty compelling today for people who actually believe in Bitcoin, but the real unlock is when people really start to see that saving in dollars just isn't going to work.
Yeah. Well, what would you say to people who are looking at the banks racing to integrate Bitcoin and crypto and saying that all these Bitcoin startups that are Bitcoin first, Bitcoin only, they're going to get blown out by these institutions because they're going to have the capital, the scale, the network effect of a client base already to just implement this overnight?
Yeah, I think that I'm not really worried at all about that because I don't see a future where JP Morgan is putting Bitcoin side by side in your checking account in the near future. They just don't actually, they don't believe that. They don't believe in that future. It'll always be this like side thing that uses a third party that's kind of a crappy user experience. And like we'll get some people using it, but like they're not actually going to build a competitive product because the organization and its DNA does not believe this is the future. And if it is, and if they eventually like realize that and they catch up, well, you know, the markets move like, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. If JP Morgan eventually integrates Bitcoin as a first-class citizen, we will have grown tremendously as a business as well. It will be because like a company like River has taken market share. That's why they would start doing it. And the inertia that they have is so large. It's not like they're going to die, but it wouldn't be like they would just be trying to catch up with us.
Yeah. I'm a big believer in that too. This is like a Bitcoiner and who knows, we're early adopters and who knows if the later adoption waves and the people come on those waves will care at all. But I would find it very hard to believe to trust JP Morgan with my Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, they'll care about user experience and they'll care about what they're getting, right? And I think that that's where you compete. They'll care about service, user experience, and economics.
Yeah. And I think the upstarts definitely beat on UX and it's easier.
Yeah.
Well, that's like, that's another interesting topic we dive into, like with this wave of AI tools coming to market. I don't think I've talked to you directly about this. Like, are you guys leveraging these tools at River? And if so, has it changed your perspective on what the future trajectory of the growth of your business from a revenue profitability standpoint, but more importantly, from like a headcount standpoint, has it affected your views on this at all?
I have kind of two competing thoughts in my head at the same time about these things. On one hand, I do believe that as these tools continue to accelerate in their capabilities, it'll unlock tremendous potential to move faster for our business. It's already, pretty heavily improved the productivity for our engineering team in a number of places, but not every place. And I think that really what a lot of these tools are surfacing to people is the hard part was never really writing the code for most things anyways. There are certain like tasks and aspects of building an application or a tech company where just like writing the code and getting this thing done is like just a lot easier now. But all of the consequential things that you do are usually not that. The consequential things that you do are usually require humans to synthesize the complexity and apply taste and their understanding of their client base to prioritize and make changes to the product. And AI is accelerating like subsets of tasks that allow you to do that, but it doesn't really accelerate a lot of the human decision-making bottleneck there. And I don't see a short-term future where it does. So, but there are some areas where it really accelerates things. Like yesterday, for example, like when we generate account statements for our customers, right? We had to use this like PDF tool where we like generate the data and then like we use this other system that like generates the PDF because PDFs are like super complicated to understand how to make them. But with AI, I was like, hey guys, like try and just make the PDF directly now and write the code to just generate the PDF directly because these AIs understand how to make PDFs, you know, and they have all that information. And they were like, you know, they were like a little hesitant because like no one really does this. It's very unusual to do something like this. And I was like, hey guys, like, look, it's a different world right now. Let's just try it. And we experimented for like half a day yesterday and it actually worked beautifully. And so we were able to delete like this whole, you know, subsystem that we just don't need anymore. And so there are things like that where it's really like magical. But I don't think like it isn't unlocking us like making better product decisions, or it's not like saving us time sitting in a room and debating like the right, you know, design decisions. So those are like my two sort of competing takes.
No, and I would completely agree. I mean, we've been leaning in heavily over the last month and a half. We've been leaning in heavily for the last 2 years, really. But now, like the OpenClaw phenomena, we've been using that for like 6 weeks now, or 5 or 6 weeks, and it's really extended what we can do. And to your point about taste, like there's a ton of ideas I've had. It was like, okay, I would love to do this, but we're bootstrapped. We run lean. We only have so much capacity to try these things. And now with OpenClaw, like it's allowing us to like sprint towards a lot of the goals, but taste is like we revamped our morning newsletter 5 days a week. And it's pretty much not automated, but the AI or little clanker builds it. But there's a lot of taste and it's collaborative sort of endeavor between myself and my agent Martin, who's a more sophisticated version of Marty, throughout the day to sort of just get the stories that we're going to include in the newsletter and the structure. But there's a lot of taste. It's like curating, but now I have the ability, instead of spending 2-3 hours actually formatting and putting things into the newsletter, I can just throughout the day put links in a Google Sheet, with some notes, voice to text notes about what I want to touch on with a particular topic. And then at the end of the day, hit up Martin and be like, okay, go to the Google Sheet, look at what I put in there, and let's put together the newsletter. And 30 minutes later, it's ready to go. The taste is extremely important. But in terms of being able to get stuff done, particularly with small teams, it's accelerating that. And I think there's a misnomer going around out there too, which is, you're not going to have to work more. But if you have high agency and willpower, it's just like I've had more 1 a.m. nights over the last 4 weeks than I have in like the last 2 years, because I'm just like, oh, we can go after these ideas now.
Absolutely. And I think what it does, and from a hiring perspective and a headcount perspective, is it honestly hasn't changed our headcount projections. It's just solidified and hammered home the qualifiers that we have for who we hire. We just will only hire people we think are high agency, who have taste, who can synthesize and understand the business problems, hire people who have the qualities that we need to solve the real human bottlenecks that still exist that these AIs aren't solving. And you can still get more done by hiring more of those people. You just don't need the people who are doing busy work and the code monkeys who aren't thinking from first principles and understanding the business. So that's my take.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a brave new world. It's so funny because I get the sense that we're just like teetering. Like the world right now is like equally exhilarating and completely unnerving, because it's like we can go many different directions. Obviously, geopolitically, everybody's meeting the Strait of Hormuz right now to figure out what we're going to do with Iran. We got, like we said, the Epstein files here. We got this AI explosion. You've got the high velocity trash economy just accelerating at a crazy pace with prediction markets. Now we have attention markets that just dropped on Zora.
What is attention markets?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Remember Zora was like a Coinbase base. They pivoted and they're on Solana now, but you can
coin your content kind of thing.
It's like, well, not only that, but people can bet on trends, can basically ride trends and monetize it somehow. I don't understand how it works or why you would want to do it, but.
Well, I think there is this thing where, you know, what we've seen in the last 10 years, especially in our industry, and what we're seeing now leaving crypto and just moving elsewhere with prediction markets, is you just have this like class of people that chases financialization and new games they can convince normies to play because they can just extract. And I think that's like, we're just seeing that now. Like, I think prediction markets is a big example of that. It has like some really legitimate, cool use cases, like trying to just understand what's going to happen or the truth, which I think is actually very cool and innovative. But actually like 90-something% of the volume is just sports betting. so it's like, you know, at the end of the day, like you take this technology and then it's just like, oh, let's just, yeah, like extract from a subset of the population who we can farm.
Well, I will say, it is like sports betting is, especially if you're spending all your money on it or all your time on it, you shouldn't be doing that. But if you're trying to compare it to like DraftKings or like the big books, it's like, okay, I can see the argument, like prediction markets make more sense because there's no house to take a big and to play both sides. Like it's peer to peer. If you want to take that risk,
you can also trade in and out of a position,
yeah,
which is interesting. You can like get out, right?
Yeah. So like compared to the status quo, I think it is net benefit for consumers from a fairness perspective. But if you don't have impulse control, you can still lose all your money in these prediction markets.
I mean, the real fight is the state level, where you had Texas and California that just sports betting was illegal. And now the prediction markets are going, oh, well, we're federally, you know, regulated. Charter, and we're allowed to do this everywhere. And then all of a sudden, everyone in California and Texas can now sports bet when they couldn't before. And it's like this big states' rights question, which is also like kind of an interesting thing. We'll see how that plays out. It might end up in the Supreme Court.
Yeah. I feel like we're fighting all these battles. And I think the core of the battle is the essence of our humanity as we transition to the digital age. Like, what are we going to get? Are we going to get like a Bitcoin standard with lower time preference and better capital allocation, better incentive alignment, or do we just steamroll into Weimar version 2 for the 21st century?
It's unclear. It's unclear. I mean, we might get a, it might allow us to go back to focusing on real things, like, I don't know, a bull kit, you know, a white pill scenario would be these AIs allow us to get out of the email jobs, like the email jobs go away and everyone actually has to go back to doing real things. This like, you know, the last few decades where everything was just a financial abstraction and, you know, like fewer and fewer people did like real things, in the real world. You know, maybe that gets reversed because like a lot of that can just be done by AIs and we all go back to, you know, manufacturing or farming or, I don't know, or maybe all of that just also gets automated with robotics because the AI advances so fast that, and then we're all like, well, what do we even do now? And there's actually just like 1,000 people who are like high agency and high IQ enough to actually be valuable. And everyone else is just like, you know,
permanent underclass.
Right. Exactly. Like, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Well, that's like, I had a conversation with Justin Moon last week about this, and it's something I've been trying to grapple with in my head. So I think, particularly our generation, I think we broke out of it, but there's a ton of like preconceived notions of how the world works and how humans operate. And I think one of those is that there's just like a natural distribution of people who are high agency and those who have the fluoride stare, if you will. And I don't know, I've been trying to think, like, is there a way that you can instill and engender a culture of high agency if we recognize that it is what you're going to need to have to be successful in this new age?
Okay, cool.
I go back and forth. Like, I can totally, and I probably lean actually towards there's just a natural distribution of people who have it and people who don't. But I'm curious, like, is there like a Spartan-like culture you could put out there to convince people that you need to develop the skills to have agency?
I think there'll also, you know, be it more and more interesting conversations around collectivism, where I think people like might start thinking about collectivism a little bit differently as the technology progresses, if it really does truly begin to advance. And you know, I think there is like this, like in the last sort of 30 years or so, or maybe even 50 years, you could say like Americans like frowned upon collectivism because everything was just working really well for us. And like being individual, being independent and high agency, just like made you wealthy. And if that stops being the case, then all of a sudden collectivism might start being viewed differently. Like, hold on a second. Like, we need to all like, who is my group who I band together with to make sure that like we all benefit and we protect ourselves, and put our group first, because being alone, you know, just doesn't work anymore. And maybe like the fact that, you know, we were able to be, have this ethos at all was just because the US just worked so well. And you know, what's the future of that? Just some unformed thoughts.
Yeah. Right, cause it's all, I mean, I seen it up close and personal, like it's definitely massively beneficial. But it's still not perfect. Like, I have to slap my clanker around every once in a while. Like, hey, you did that wrong. You're not autonomous yet.
They don't learn. And I think there's still some major like break. There's still some major breakthroughs before these things are actually changing everything.
Well, that's the other thing I wonder. Like, how much of like what's being put out there by Sam Altman, by Dario, others is just like them pushing their book and like trying to get their valuations up, raise another $100 billion.
Exactly. It's hard to say. It's hard to really, because obviously these things are revolutionary, but at the same time, there's obviously something missing with them. Right. You know, it's like that classical conversation of why do we need to train these things with gigawatts of compute or hundreds of megawatts of compute and all of the information on the internet, when a human doesn't need any of that. You know, there's something like a human doesn't need to all the information on the internet to be able to be useful. So like there's something fundamental missing in our understanding of like building intelligence. And the real maybe scary thing is if we figure that out, that's when it gets scary. And until then, maybe it's actually just kind of like, I don't know, these things are just really smart but dumb at the same time.
Yeah. That's, yeah, I mean, I think there's been more discussion arising around this too. I mean, the just separating intelligence and consciousness, like, can you actually be genuinely intelligent in the sense that you can learn new things and have creative thought if you're not conscious? And can these things ever be conscious?
I think the answer is probably at some point we'll get there, but I'm also not convinced it's like going to happen in the next few years. I'm not convinced this, like, I could be wrong. I don't have, like, you know, I wouldn't have predicted how good these things are today, 5 years ago. So I want to, like, you know, I do think we should consider a world where extrapolating these things, getting smarter and smarter and accelerating pace does happen. But at the same time, I just, like, from a first principles perspective, have a hard time seeing how throwing more energy at compute solves that fundamental problem of these things aren't learning. These things aren't handling novel tasks. And, you know, every time you send it something, like, it has a context window, it doesn't remember anything, right? And those are problems that they're working on. The question is, like, how will they actually be solved in any near-term future? I don't know.
Yeah. Is it a problem as insurmountable as scaling logical qubits for quantum computers? Who knows?
Yeah. That's
What are your thoughts on the whole quantum debate?
You know, I hate being in a position my argument is betting against humans figuring something out. Right. So, like, I hate sort of being somebody who sits there and says, quantum computing will never work, and here's why. And the problem, I hate being in that position because it's non-falsifiable, right? You can't prove they won't figure something out. But at the same time, like, there is some truth to it. Like, it's a really hard problem. I think it's probably overblown, but, like, also, what if it's not, right? There's a lot of information asymmetry here. Like, understanding quantum computing is not easy. It's a highly specialized field. And from what I can tell, there is real progress happening. And I don't think, what makes Bitcoin great is that I know, I have high confidence that it's going to be functioning effectively 10, 20, 30 years into the future. And so we always want that to be true. We always want people to believe that Bitcoin will always function and be secure many, many years into the future. So because of that, I do think we do need to care about this. I do think we need to, there is a lot of development effort already going into post-quantum signature algorithms for Bitcoin and what transitioning to that could look like. And I think that's important work. And I think it should be done with conservatively, but with some urgency. But we also don't want to rush something that creates a vulnerability. So that's my take.
I completely agree. And I think that's been the most frustrating thing about the whole narrative around Bitcoin, its relationship with potential quantum breakthroughs at some point in the future, is that people are saying, you're not doing anything. Will the devs do something? It's like, well, this has been an ongoing discussion for over a decade. There's a lot of research being done. There's a BIP out there that could potentially be merged if you want to put your Bitcoin in an address that's nested in a tap leaf that is quantum resistant. You may be able to do that at some point soon. But then to your point, I mean, you don't want to rush it because you could introduce some sort of critical vulnerability that destroys the network itself. But I think another interesting perspective that somebody like you could provide, like, what would the logistics of your business, like the transition to this for your business, look like? Like, how many different sort of things would you have to change if we were to transition to this?
So there's a few components here. One is cold storage. One is a hot wallet, which is where, you know, most transactions are going in and out of every day. What we would probably do is, let's just put totally aside, how do we handle like the lost coins, or, you know, the coins that don't get moved over to a new quantum secure signature? Let's just assume, you know, okay, we have a soft fork. It introduces a quantum secure signature, like Sphinx plus, like something like, you know, Jonas Nick is working on. What we would probably do is move all cold storage coins over to that. Once it was, you know, once we felt really, really confident about it, we wouldn't do it like right away. Because presumably this upgrade would happen many years before a viable quantum computer actually existed. So we would, you know, let it run its course, you know, do a lot of testing, have it live on the network for hopefully a year or two. We would move all cold storage coins over to this new, new signature scheme. And the hot wallet, we'd probably still keep running with the old signature scheme, but we'd start building and getting the, you know, getting things in place to support this new signature scheme. Now, there's a lot of open questions from a wallet experience perspective for both consumer self-custody and also businesses, where some of the things that make operating wallets very convenient today might not work. For example, like BIP32 derivation, right? Being able to derive addresses from a public key, those tools probably won't exist for post-quantum algorithms. And so things might get a little clunkier. We might see
signing take longer.
Longer, or just the transaction might be bigger, right? Might be more expensive. And so it would be a hit to self-custody usability, unfortunately. But you know, if that's where the tech goes, we don't really have a choice.
Yeah. No, I had Jonas and Mikhail on. We talked about this. That's like what I think many people are like pushing a rush to this don't realize. It's like, hey, we have a bunch of standards, partially signed Bitcoin transactions, the Lightning Network, you have the HTLCs, you have all these things. You can't just like upgrade now and bork all this stuff that's been built over the course of 17 years. It's like, hey, you have to think through this strategically, coordinate across the Bitcoin network and all the individual actors within it and put a concerted effort forth. And then on the hardware wallet side, like that's actually a business opportunity for somebody who can build a beefy hardware wallet that is like high power, can actually sign the signatures in a timely manner.
Mm-hmm.
I would think as well.
Yeah. It will lead to opportunities. Like you said, it's hard to suss out sort of the economic opportunists pushing the quantum fear versus the actual technical reality. And I think that at the end of the day, really no one knows, right? You don't know what's going to come out of the mind of some guy in the lab at Google.
Or some model. Maybe the models figure out how to learn actually. And they're like, hey, guess what? Right. And we figured it out.
I think what we do know for sure, and we've known for Bitcoin's lifetime, is theoretically, like the laws of physics do not prohibit this. It is an engineering problem. It is not does not require breaking the laws of physics. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's the scary thing about cryptography in general, is there's no law of physics that says a certain cryptographic primitive is secure. It's more like
probabilistic.
We haven't been able to prove it's not hard, but we can't prove it is. You know, that's kind of the scary thing about math in general, is it's not really constrained by physics.
Yeah. Just gave the 2025 retrospective. We're almost 2 months into 2026. What are you excited about? What are you looking forward to? What are you focused on? Whether it's at River or Bitcoin generally right now?
We're focused on this dual money vision. We want to, you know, historically, we were this place where people came to buy Bitcoin. We want to be the central hub for people's money. We want to be that place where you bank. And so, you know, the future for us is this year like focusing on building the future of Bitcoin banking, having dollars in Bitcoin in one place. We are not a chartered bank. We partner with a bank to provide dollar functionality. But, you know, I do believe that this is the future of money. And so that's our focus. So we're working on things like bill pay, you know, being able to pay your bills from your River account, making it just more and more compelling and easy to use Bitcoin and dollars in one place. For Bitcoin more broadly, I think the quantum stuff is going to be a big focus of conversation. I think that we have a big opportunity there to show people that, again, Bitcoin is the most secure and certain chain in the world, and we think about the long tail risks. So I do think that conversation will dominate over the coming year. And I think every time a new blog post comes out from a quantum lab, it'll reflame, you know, reignite these conversations about Bitcoin and quantum. And I think every month that happens, we'll have better and better answers for people.
Yeah. That's funny too. I think we caught at least some of the grifters yesterday, because 2 weeks ago we had a large downward difficulty adjustment. There are many people on the quantum side saying, look, the miners recognize the quantum risk. They're unplugging. They're giving up on their investment. This was happening while a winter storm was taking over most of the United States.
Right.
And hash rate was either turning off because they were involved in demand response programs, or the actual data center had some disruptions due to inches of ice falling from the sky. And then yesterday we had an upwards adjustment of 14.7%. We're above where we were before that. It's like, well, it was a quantum.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's always someone who's got a bad take that goes viral, and all of a sudden, you know, everyone's texting you about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, just wait two weeks. Well, Alex, it's always great catching up, sir.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Honored to call you a friend and a colleague in this Bitcoin network. Are we colleagues? Yeah. Colleagues in the network? Is that what we're going to call it? I don't like community either. I don't think we can call it community. You
know, we're actors.
Yeah.
Actors in the network. This is more of the mathematical term, I guess. colleague is, I like colleague. Brothers.
Yeah. Brothers. I like it. Brothers. Brothers in arms here. We'll link to these reports in the show notes. Keep crushing the research. It's highly valuable. And I think it's great to be able to have this research to point to be like, hey, Lightning's not dead. Actually, it's better than ever. Yes, individuals are losing their share of Bitcoin overall, but businesses are adopting it alongside governments and institutions. It's not just these large actors that people don't like coming in. It's mom and pop main street businesses as well. I think it's very beneficial for the pitch to people who are skeptical.
Absolutely. Yeah, excited to share more there.
All right. Well, a little tease to end it. We'll catch up again at some point soon.
All right. Looking forward.
All right. Peace and love, freaks.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.